Welcome to Conversations on Genocide, where we unravel the untold stories of survival, resilience, and the unwavering pursuit of justice in the face of history's darkest chapters. Learning from academics and professionals, genocide survivors, and descendants of survivors, each series in the podcast will delve into the detailed history behind contemporary and historical cases of genocide. We aim to shed light on topics that are often overlooked by examining the various social concepts and theories that are interwoven into the histories of these genocides. Please be advised that the content featured in this podcast may be disturbing and emotionally intense. Listener discretion is advised. For specific content warnings and for resources on mental health, please see the show notes. Lastly, please note that the opinions of our guests do not necessarily reflect the opinions of the hosts or of Genocide Watch. We hope today's episode expands your understanding of genocide.
Thank you so much for being here on our podcast. I'm really excited to have this conversation. And would you first like to introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about like your professional work?
Okay. Thank you very much, everyone. My name is Joseph Moses Oleshangai. I'm a Tanzanian citizen from the Maasai community, which is very important because it is the same community that I will be sharing some of the experience from the northern part of the country. Professionally, I'm a human rights lawyer. I work, of course, in the NGO sector in a form of delivering legal aid. So it's a legal aid organization. It's actually the Tanzania largest human rights organizations and also the largest legal aid organizations, for which we are responsible to do some sort of legal aid for indigenous people. But I'm particularly working in a matter related to Maasai rights. Is Maasai my community and the problem that the government is forcing us into. And I'm actually from Ngorongoro, the same place we'll be discussing throughout. Whatever that I talk, of course, I can talk in a human rights way as a human rights lawyer, some legal things, but also as a community member. So I'll not be speaking for other people, but to myself and my family and everyone.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. Yeah. And we definitely do have some questions that get to that more community aspect. But yeah, I'm glad that you brought that up too. And what like inspired you to get involved in like legal work and like human rights work?
It's a very long story. What inspired me to be working on human rights is actually what inspired me to become a lawyer. I remember the first idea to study law, and I can't lie, but by that time I never really knew about, I'm from a modest Maasai family, limited access to many social service schools and anything else. And so by that time, you know, when I was in primary school, so because the idea of studying law started when I was a kid, literally in my early 10s. I was in primary school then. And every time that I come home, every time that I'm with my parents, they always say, the government is saying this. The government intends to bring these restrictions. The government is planning against this. And I was like, these people need to be assisted in some ways. So that's the first idea of thinking of law. I never knew law literally as a discipline that I can get money out of it. I was knowing of a judge, thinking is someone presiding, and the lawyer on the other side, no more about that. Then going all through to university now studying law, I found it like it's a very broad discipline. Not necessarily about human rights, because I knew law as a human right element. So yes, and now after actually finishing my university degree, it's the same time it coincides now with the problem we're speaking. So to me, it's something I thought I would be doing. Sadly, of course, it's coming in greater ways. So yeah.
Yeah, no, thank you for sharing. And now moving on, we have some questions just to establish some quick historical background. And this is where you can talk a little bit about yourself too, if you'd like. But for people who aren't as familiar with the history of Tanzania, could you describe the culture of the Maasai people and maybe what it was like growing up for you? And just providing some general context.
So the Maasai community live both in Tanzania and Kenya, southern Kenya, northern through to central Tanzania. They have been here over centuries. There are many literatures about the Maasai, but at least by 18th century, they occupied a big chunk of what is today Tanzania, throughout the north to central, Dodoma, Arusha, Kilimanjaro, some part of Tanga, some places in Iringa. So the Maasai are the pastoralist people. And it is a pastoral indigenous community who, in many ways, when I say pastoralism, the cattle is both the economy, is also the culture, and in many ways is the spirituality. They believe in cattle. It's not just an animal that you can say, let us go and slaughter. So it's the economy. They can trade, they can do anything to sustain their livelihoods, but also is the culture. There are cultural things you cannot do without a cow. So there is so much attachment with the Maasai, the cattle. And then there is so much attachment of the Maasai community with the land. So it's the people of cattle in certain territories. So to ask the Maasai, when we speak about the land, so the government is saying, oh, get out. There are so much of the land out there. To us, we are not losing a portion of land. We don't need 10 acres. Is the land is a sort of an entity with purpose? Is the land that has the culture in it? Is the land that has spiritual elements in it? Is the land that supports our main economy, which is pastoralism? So when the government says, we want to put the hotel here, you can get some of the land somewhere. We never understand, because there are places where all the Maasai of this country, of Tanzania, do their spiritual practices or cultural, the rite of passage, for example, only in two places. One, in Ngorongoro. The other, and it's not an alternative, you do stage one somewhere, you do the second stage somewhere else. So one in Ngorongoro, one in almost in the western slope of Mount Kilimanjaro. So you force the Maasai out of Ngorongoro, then you are telling the Maasai you can no longer practice your like cultural things related to that. So land is an entity with many purpose. And so then because you asked me about Tanzania, so the Maasai are living in Tanzania and Kenya. In Tanzania particularly, because I think it is important to understand, out of 61 million populations, almost 95% or from 90% are Bantu speaking groups. And then you have the second groups being the Kushites, who are also have some elements of the north from Somali come down, is the second groups. Then you have the Nilotics, Hemetics and the Nilotics group of the Maasai and the Barbaics. Then the last one, you have the Hadza. So out of the 61 million people, you have close to less than a million Maasai population in Tanzania. So in those groups, they are the minority if you try to segregate in that way. Since independence, of course, Tanzanians are peaceful people. So the Maasai in some ways has been sailing through like any other community. But the Maasai particularly are known, not only because they are close to the tourism leading areas, but also the keeping of the culture. And so they are so resistant with any incoming manipulation, assimilations, and others. So in some ways are the largest group that maintains their original culture, in many ways, of course, followed by the Barbaric. So actually, the minority groups are the one keeping the culture in many ways, the territories in many ways, which is actually part of the problem that we are having now, because some of the many groups are seeing the Maasai occupying so much of the lands compared to the rest, because they are using it for some of the cultures, for some of the economy, like pastoralism and things like that. But over the years, there has been some sort of element of systematic marginalizations of the Maasai over years, from actually after Independence Day. The last time the Maasai has been in peace was before the colonial period. Then the systematic land grabbing from the colonial times, then making of the, actually the first protected areas in Tanzania were made in Maasai areas. So the colonialists made Serengeti as the first national park, and all the Maasai territories as game controls. Now, because the Maasai do not consume the wildlife, so it was easy to establish game control within the Maasai areas because you can come and hunt. They never had issues with that. So I can say there has been some systematic marginalization, but it has never been in the means, in the standard, in the nature that we are found ourselves in.
Yeah, no, thank you for explaining all of that. Yeah, that does make sense. And I had a quick question, a quick clarifying question based on something you said, because you mentioned that like a lot of the Maasai communities, they're near the tourism areas. So does tourism impact like the lands that the Maasai people live on, or like the culture in any way?
Okay, yes. Maasai particularly, because the place, for example, I'm from is Ngorongoro, is also known as Ngorongoro Conservation Area. So is our home, but to the government standard is a conservation area, and to UNESCO is a World Heritage Site. And so is a World Heritage Site that does not include our culture, our spirituality, anything of us as part of that heritage. So is a World Heritage without us. And so those international standards to begin with are actually part of the problems, because UNESCO always says the mass are becoming so many, find some way to get them out. And we have many reports of that. And World Heritage Sites come and says, and actually their visit was the past 1 week. They come to Tanzania, the UNESCO, ICOMOS, IUCN, they just talk to the governments. They never talk to us, because we are like a subject of the process, so they can just decide with the government, despite our intention and the plan to meet them. This has been the case all the years. So you have international standard in the area, but that's our home. Then you have the government policy that this is a conservation area, and then you have many tourists. Of course, there are many hotels. There are bad government policies that has struggled the people for many years to become so poor. And then you expose the Maasai to tourism. And now, which otherwise you are going to change the culture in many ways. Some people to use different mechanism for livelihood, but which actually tend to ruin the culture and many other social fabric of the community. So yes, the tourism, actually Maasai lives in one of the most visited places in tourism. 52% of the tourists who visited Tanzania in 2019 visited my area, 52%. That will not leave without affecting the culture and many other aspects of the community.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. Yeah, and I'm glad that you brought up too the part about like international like groups and like UNESCO and things like that, because I think in recent years like they've come under fire, which justifiably so, like those standards like don't always help with
and
anything.
Actually, for example, there are things I will talk later, but there was an occasion we went to court. The government is paralyzing every social institution, and we went to court saying, but we are human beings, we deserve life like the rest. And the government responded, no, we are being told by UNESCO to paralyze everything. And actually, I did actually send last week to listen to UNESCO, telling them, even if you are not listening to us, but the government is saying this in court.
Yeah, no, that's, it's crazy. UNESCO, I feel like some of those UN bodies too, they just don't really have the people's interest in mind. It's all like a geopolitical game. But yeah, and you touched on this a little bit already, but if you'd like to explain more in depth, how have the Maasai people been like discriminated against and targeted throughout history? Or what's the background that people need to know to understand some of the current issues today?
Okay, I'll try to be brief. The problem we're speaking now of the Maasai is a creation of many factors, many forces behind, but it actually started with the colonial times. Like any other community, Maasai were affected with the colonialism. So imposition of the colonialisms, then Maasai were living, I said earlier, Maasai do not feed with the old animals. So there are so many of the animals in Maasai areas. Literally, you can find elephants exactly within the cow groups moving together. They never had problems. And you can find, actually, zebra, when I go to my home place, one day I woke up around midnight, just got out of my house, and I was having a torch. So I think the torch, and I saw zebra like 2 inches from my cow enclosure. And I was like, what is this, are they doing here? So the colonial regime saw those, our areas, our ancestral areas, as prime areas for hunting and for other conservation mechanisms. And the first one, as I said earlier, Serengeti and Ngorongoro were the first attempt in Tanzania and maybe in Africa to create a conservation area. And the conservation thinking that tend to believe we cannot conserve a place where there are people. So the first people who were evicted in Tanzania for conservation were the Maasai. And it's not the story people. It included my father, who was living by that time in Serengeti. So was actually they were having a bomb mine in Ngorongoro, then in Serengeti. So they were moved to the other side, which is now Ngorongoro, which fortunately they had some settlement already. Some were not having, so they were actually moved to the other side. Then there were a debate then between several American groups. There were 33, led by the former president of AUCN, Lee Tablot, 33 organizations from US, several from UK, several from Germany then, saying we should take the Maasai all through the Ngorongoro and Serengeti, all out. And then there was, of course, Mau Mau in Kenya, and the colonial government feared that the Maasai might join them. And so a compromise was reached that they should retain Ngorongoro, which is actually my home place now. Then after independence, there has been some several attempts. And important is, because I mentioned about UNESCO, in 1979, Ngorongoro was made a World Heritage Site. And in 1980, it was made again by UNESCO as a man and biosphere reserves. And the same year, Tanzanian government approached UNESCO to tell them there is a need to permission a team to take the Maasai out of Ngorongoro. And UNESCO then said, okay, we need to have an independent team to investigate. And the two professors were sent, Professor Catherine Homewood and Alan Rogers, who then went up writing a book known as Maasai Land Ecology. And in that book, they said, actually, we found that the government wanted something to justify displacement, but we found the contrary, so leave the Maasai alone. But in 1985, another person wrote a book who said the government is investing on poverty as a mechanism to force everyone out. So if they become poor, then they can get out on their own. And then after 40 years, in 2017, our government now comes and says, these people are so poor, so we should take them out to address poverty, forgetting it is actually their own creation. And then they come and say, they never go to school, and so we need to take all of them out. So actually they said they are not educated, they are so poor. And they say, of course, this place is for ecology and they're becoming so many, their livestock, so many. And after that, they never come to us and say, you people, this is what we're thinking. What's your opinion? In 2021, because this is very significant, for the first time, the president stood and says, she said, with the problem in Ngorongoro, I'm not happy with it. Whether you are going to take them out or not, I don't know, but do something. 6 days later, because the president spoke on 6 April 2021, on 12 April 2021, the government wrote a lengthy notice saying the following Maasai are illegal immigrants, close to 200 families. They were told to get out in 30 days. Again, they said, the following infrastructures, which is very important for you to note, the following infrastructures were built without consent of the government. 9 government primary schools. Then the government says it was built without our consent, but it was built by them. So 9 government primary schools, 6 dispensaries out of the only 7 that exist. Police station, anyone will understand, like, no community build their own police stations. 4 churches out of the only 5. There were Catholic Church, there were Anglican, there were Lutherans. And actually, I say 6 out of 7 dispensaries, they left one because it was serving governments, technocrats. And with the church, they left the one serving the government technocrats. And so, okay, you create now a place, you have dispute, there are no police station, you want to go to, you have some, maybe you have, you are a Christian, you cannot go to church, you want your kid to go to schools, there are no schools, you are sick, there are no dispensaries. So 6 days after the president's statement, and then we reacted, of course, saying, no, this is terrorism. This is how terrorists all this world work. You target the place that pain the most. You don't fight, you attack some crucial infrastructure like dispensaries and others. And then they reacted, say, okay, you people, we are going to abandon the idea. This after almost a week after that, a week or so. Then I said April, then a year later, less than a year actually, on September, October, we're just ordinary people. So one of the government ministers was speaking with the conservation official, the head of the conservation area of the place that I am saying is the conservation area, but is our home. The person literally who decides everything for us. And they were saying there is need for, you actually use the English word, there is a need to invent conspiracies against the Maasai people to get them out. And then 4 months later, in mid-January, from January 15, 16, all Tanzania media, I can say, all Tanzania media were all paid by the government to go to Ngorongoro. And then reports, some says, these people are dying of hunger. These people are dying of poverty. And then their livestock are so many, and they forgot. That was from 16 January 2022 to all through, actually. Then in February, they went to parliament without ever coming to us and says, you people, this is the idea that we are having. Then in parliament, the idea now that let's use the military, take everyone out. And now trying to assess whether we have anyone in government, no. Anyone to say for us? Then in March, because it's a turn of events, the government now came and wrote another letter. You remember the notice of 12 April 2021. Then they wrote now a notice saying, they wrote to the government primary schools, government secondary schools, because we had 3 secondary schools. They wrote to all of them, telling them, any money that we ever gave you, please transfer it to this account. You remember when they intended to demolish, we reacted, and they say, okay, we are going to suspend. And now they come with the idea, okay, we take away the money. This is what the government that was suggesting August 2022. And then now they crashed their own, like their dispensaries, their schools. They are not money. So if it's a dispensary, then not receiving a coin from the government, then it's the end of it. Then they wrote to the medical flying service. When I was a kid, there was a small plane landing in my village. Is a Catholic affiliated organization that has been working in Maasai areas for the last more than 50 years. From actually 1960s, late 1960s. And they wrote to them in March 2022. They were told, you are not allowed to land in this area. And they responded, but this is our key area of operation. How can we avoid? You are not allowed to fly. As we speak here, they are not allowed to fly. Their only crime is they are serving people that the government do not want to be served. And then they went to the Catholic hospital. We want you to downgrade this hospital into. So they created a policy to make sure that the church will not function, which is actually still the war we are in. So we have been doing some advocacy with the church. We went to Europe together. We went to Vatican, actually, trying to at least persuade the church to be speaking. Because if the church is to crash the hospital, then all the people will be fleeing. But if the hospital will be there, then at least we can be resisting in many ways. Then, because it's very important to understand, is a systematic plan. It's not just because we're speaking in one area, is the place that I'm from. Already in 2022, by June, 75,000 people were displaced in Loliondo. They just went with the military and they told everyone, by tomorrow, we do not want anyone here. All of them were displaced in a day. And whoever was found, actually, because they went on 8, they arrested all the political leaders, all of them, on 9 June. Then they started marking the boundaries of the area for hunting, but there are people within. And on 27 June, they told everyone, by the end of business tomorrow, we do not want to see anyone here. And some of them also were reckless enough to stay, and their cows were shot and killed by the military. And then they want to force another 100,000 people in Ngorongoro. So Loliondo is almost 70,000 people in Ngorongoro, 100,000 people, of whom the government has already ejected 4,000, as we speak here. Then many still remains. We are speaking about close to 97,000, 98,000, whom do not receive any government facilities in anything. And on 28 May 2022, another government, the predecessor of the now government spokesperson, who is now the permanent secretary of Ministry of Information, said, actually was asked, why are you using paralyzing social service as a mechanism to force people out? He said, the government stakeholders have said, this is the only way you can crash and everyone will get up. So you choose, is you create conditions of life that end in slow death. You don't get anything. Or you displace. So there is only two alternatives. You flee or you remain and die. And then how can you force that? You paralyze everything. You do not get water. You do not get medicine. You do not get schools. You want to retain your employment, you should get out. You do not want, you'll be fired. So several has already made a decision, of course, to get out, to retain something for their families. And so is not something small in many ways. I said, the intent is actually, because the place that some are being taken, 700 kilometers away. So you destroy the social fabrics, what make the community together. And then in a very systematic way, local media, you'll never find any content about the Maasai displacement, the Maasai depressions, and things like that, because the president and all the lieutenant do not want. And the campaign is led by the prime minister. So you have the president, you have the prime minister, you have parliaments saying use guns, and now you have the actual militaries participating in the violence in Ngorongoro, in some part of Simanjiro. And then, and actually one deputy minister said, we are actually taking them out so that they live like other human beings. Is forceful assimilation so that they be like us, which is very fundamental, because it is me who decides which life do I want. It is me who decides what civility, what civilization is not modernity of having a story building is living a simple life that I think has purpose in me, connection with my ancestors, connection with the actually meaning, making meaningful to the nature. And that the government says, we should dismantle that so that they live like us. So you take out, you distract, so they cannot ever be the same people as they did, which is very fundamental. In my opinion, Jay said, you stay, you die, a flawed death, you die of disease, you die of anything. And I mentioned the medical flying service, you remember, in September last year. They said for the last 16 months, they were grounded, because they were grounded in April 2022. In the last 16 months, we are not able to vaccinate 51,000 kids. The government never actually vaccinates. So those kids are not vaccinated at all. It's not their choice, the choice of the government. So you expose them to disease. And then medical flying service had some patients somewhere. Some of the patients were HIV positive, and they were the only one supplying the medicine, ARV and others. And one of the most important cases, it's not important, it's bad, but it's important to say, there was a pregnant woman who was HIV. And the medical flying service were to deliver a therapy for the kids to be born, not to get HIV. So that will be avoiding using HIV, ARV for their lives. And the same week that the kid was born, the medical flying service were grounded. That was April 2022. And now the kid has tested HIV, which is entirely the government own creation. And then they say, that's a too terrible place. So like some people are actually saying in the media, some who have actually gone out of the area, they're saying, we have decided to go because I have lost a kid. I have lost a pregnant woman. And then the government like circulate all in the media, like you see some people are going voluntarily. That's not voluntary. It's a choice between death and becoming a refugee. And all the refugees of this world are always fleeing because they don't want to die. Anyone can flee for that reason.
Thank you for explaining all of that. I feel like now it's so clear from what you were explaining how this has just been planned out by the government. You were saying it's very systematic. And also, I thought it was interesting that what you mentioned about forced assimilation aspect, because I think that's part of so many genocides, even today too. So yeah, thank you for explaining all of that. And my next question is, you mentioned this a little bit, but especially because you talked about how several thousand people have already been displaced now. So has there already been impacts within the Maasai community with loss of culture, or how does the community resist against losing their culture?
Okay. One, because in the place that I mentioned earlier about Loliondo, they are not told where to go. Is we do not want to see you by the end of business tomorrow. You should be known whether you run out of the country, and actually some of the people run to Kenya. And some who were actually shot, because 41 people were shot, they were never allowed to be treated in Tanzania. And in September last year, they actually conducted an operation, which I would love to share my little diary that I took for the victim. They arrested close to 67 people, then put in a certain cell outside of their district. They never said where. So we just got them coincidentally. But coming to that question, in Ngorongoro particularly, the place that I'm from, I said is the World Heritage Site, so many tourisms. And so you remember I said in Ngorongoro they are paralyzing service. Then of course they told them where to go. Those fleeing now in 700 kilometers away. And then I said for pastoralism to function, because Maasai are pastoralists, for it to function, you need space. It's not like a sedentary, like we stay the same way. No. It must be a movement back and forth in search of pasture and water, which our opinion as Maasai is civilization, is how you manage ecology. And so they take them to literally town areas. You refer a place known as Msomera now. I have the map, the satellite imagery of Msomera in 2017. A village, majority of them are Maasai. And then the satellite imagery of Msomera in 2023, October, is literally an urban area. You cannot, it's the end of pastoralism. So you take Maasai out, then you ensure that in the destination, they never practice the only economy that they know, which is pastoralism. And are they prevented from practicing cultural issues? Yes. Some of the place actually the government is taking for hunting, exclusive hunting, you are not allowed to enter. There is a person, actually, the Vice President of United Arab Emirates, is having a hunting block in Loliondo, exactly where is the prayer area. But now is the camp for the hunter. You are not allowed to go there. So you are not allowed to go to pray, of course, but they come for hunting. So are they prevented? Yes, in many ways. There are places that I say the rite of passage, the Ngorongoro, for example, the Ngorongoro crater. Some people see the caldera, of course, but we see as a land, I say, is an entity with many purpose and intent. It has culture. It is the place we can grass. It is the place we can go and pray. And then you are now not allowed to access. So yes, it is affecting us in many ways.
Yeah, no, that's that story you shared about the United Arab like Emirates and the like the hunting ground, like that's just so it's just like a perfect example of how they're like preventing the continued just like practice of your culture and everything. Yeah, it's
And
just
particular,
awful.
that place is known as Alasai, which means a prayer area.
Yeah,
Prayer
right.
area. Then you are not allowed to enter, leave alone to go and pray. And someone coming to do is like when you go today to Mecca and told all the Muslims, you are not allowed to enter into Mecca. Those are our spiritual areas, which I think they should be respected.
Yeah, no, again, I feel like there's just like there's so many examples in like history where this connects to like other genocides too. I feel like it's just like the taking over of land, like getting rid of like sacred spaces. I think that's just that's so common like among other genocides
Yeah.
too. It's yeah, it's just it's awful. And I was wondering too, because you mentioned about like the Catholic Church and the government was like preventing them from helping and landing their airplane. But has there been any other like organizations or like other international actors who have been able to help the Maasai people? Or is all of that, does the government prevent all of that? Or
Actually, the forces behind it are so many. I said earlier, there were many international NGOs back in the 60s. Then I said, what the government is doing now is for business. Of course, they claim its conservation is number one because you displace the Maasai, you bring a person to come and kill the same animals that you are saying I'm actually displacing the Maasai for them. So companies like that from the Middle East, from United Arab Emirates is just one. Governments in Europe, for example, Germans are pouring a lot of money to literally displace our people. And we know, I said UNESCO visited here last week. The last schedule was actually online. It was the last day they were here. They arrived on 3rd February. We're not allowed to meet them, but international organizations like Frankfurt Zoological Society were allowed, and they presented that the massive population is becoming so much. So yes, is our government assisted by many forces behind it? The conservation groups, the hunting groups, and many other people with different purpose, particularly people who need the hotel. So my home place is so good to become a hotels. And they see like when I'm having a modest house, is like the misuse of the resources. So how can we get this person out? They say he's poor. Get out of here. They say they never gone to school. So let them get out to get educations. Then do they really need us to go to school? And then another, which I cannot ignore, is mass community being close to 1 million is small compared to 61, but it's not a small number of people. Not having any person in the central governments, one, or in the mid-level anywhere, or in the military, one, even to call and say what is going on, is the result of historical systematic targeting. And I actually, in December last year, I went to somewhere, and I met with an old man. He's a Maasai. And he told me he was once actually working in the Prime Minister's office back in the 80s. And there was one Maasai Prime Minister who died by a very suspicious circumstance, but in accidents. And after his death, his immediate predecessor, his immediate, he told him and some of the Maasai who were working in the Prime Minister's office, your God is gone. So prepare yourself for another different life. And we have it now. I never knew it before. He told me, I think he's right. So yeah. It is some sort of historical plan.
It reminds me a lot of, because I'm based in the U.S., but it reminds me a lot of when we displaced the native populations here in the U.S., and that was like a planned out system. Yeah, and it's just, yeah, it's really horrific. But yeah, no, thank you for explaining all of that. And this is a bit more hypothetical, but is there any sort of interventions or different measures or laws that you'd like to see that would help like the Maasai people, or that would be able to like have people return to their lands and things like that? I guess what would help like the Maasai people the most today?
We have tried to, of course, do some sort of interventions to, which is almost related to the question you are now asking, trying to stop what's happening. It's very difficult, particularly if the state is determined, and at least if you all know, at least for a fact, that the president is behind it. Presidents in this part of the world are so powerful. I know America is so powerful, but American president is not powerful like many of the African, because African president can decide whether you live or die. In US, he cannot decide. Then he can be voted out for violating human rights. In this part of the world, if you feel the president is on the other way, then it's always difficult to become an adversary. And the position of the president in this particular case is more than clear. So we tried, of course, to do some international campaigns, at least from starting with the media. That's what we started with. At least making it visible somewhere, because on our own, maybe we cannot afford. And then we went to court, which was another intervention we did. The place I said about Loliondo and Ngorongoro, for the last, from 2022, we had 14 cases. Any case with the outcome, we won it, but with zero purpose. I said it was declared as a hunting area by a minister. We went to court and we won the case. But in the process, the president declared the same area into another form of hunting, different from the minister. We went to court again, we challenged that, we were able to convince the court that the president never followed the law. And the government said, nevertheless, whoever came here will see the power of the government. And for the last 2 years, from June 2022, the government has seized and confiscated and sold 42,000 Maasai livestock in a span of 1.5 years. That's actually, is killing. So we have kids who are not now going to schools because the government has sold all the livestock, so they cannot afford the school fees. We have people who cannot go to hospitals far away. The government is crushing the one at home. You cannot get out because you don't have the economy. The government has taken it away purposely. So you stay, they confiscate livestock and sell. Then we tried to do some international campaign, which I say last year, we went to Germany, for example, trying to talk to the governments of Germans and other actors. You people, you are also responsible. You are fueling this problem by giving them money. We went to EU. I said we went to Vatican and for a purpose. The church in Tanzania is silent, is also a victim. They cannot speak. They know what will happen. So we went to what we think is their bosses. And of course, it has yielded some of the result, because by December, the church in Tanzania, the Catholic Church particularly, called a public rally and spoke about the issue, which is very significant, at least in some working intervention in some ways, which I said, as we speak here, the president is in Vatican talking to the Pope, and we send our letter to the Pope to request at least the Pope to say something to the president. I'm not sure if the Pope is reading or has read or is not, but at least we have delivered our message and has been received. That's part of the intervention that we have been doing. Special rapporteurs, particularly, there were 8 special rapporteurs, UN rapporteurs, who issued a statement when the violence was taking off, particularly in 2022. UN special rapporteur for indigenous people planned to visit Tanzania at particularly Ngorongoro in December 2022. It was blocked by the government. African Commission for Human and People's Rights visited in January in what was more or less a government rubber stamps. That's why they were allowed to visit. They were actually moving with the government vehicles, sleeping with the government bills, doing everything for the government. Then we requested the EU Parliament to do their own independent visit, which they were to do it in September, from September 4th. And they were blocked. The government agreed, the government scheduled, they booked the hotels for them, they booked the flight for them, and the guys were so clever enough to say, no, we cannot be used that way. We need to be independent. And they were told, but not here. So you are not allowed to visit. So it ended there. Plus UNESCO. They were all actually to visit also in September. They were blocked. And now they come in February, of course, with one of the conditions. There were one Kenyan Maasai who was to be in the UNESCO delegations. He was vetoed out by the governments. As a condition for you to visit, we do not want to see this character, which the UNESCO in some ways agreed. And that's why they come without him. And so there is trial to do some intervention. Then coming to your question, what do we think it can help and what the hope that we have? Is a very difficult, seems a million question, because we want everything. We want the rule of law, because all this is happening because internally there is no rule of law, there is no good governance, there is no democracy. Some people can literally decide to decimate populations, dismantle everything. And then some people somewhere feel like we're not obligated. So silence, there's a few people suffering. And it's always the problem, because what's happening with the Maasai is literally a genocide in the making, is the very foundation of the genocide. We always wait to see more than what's happening in Gaza, to see more than what happens anywhere in Rohingya and different other places. But then it will be too late to be doing something. But we can do now. So what we need is many people speaking, and maybe, you know, the spirit of human right, it is the Maasai who should decide whether to have a story building, to build a university, or to stay with cattle. That should be the choice of the Maasai, not of some people somewhere. And that's the most things that we need, is our people staying in the land. If they want to practice their spiritual elements, to do it without interventions by anyone. If they want to go to hospitals or to take their natural herbs, being their own decisions.
Yeah, no, and I think you bring up an interesting point with like comparing everything to like Gaza and Rohingya, because I feel oftentimes like people that are like in the like genocide prevention sphere, like they just wait for everyone to die and then they say, oh, this was such a horrible thing, but you could have been doing something this entire time. They have the, you know,
and,
the power.
And more particularly because if you are to read both the Genocide Convention and the Rome Statute as what constitutes genocide, is not always necessarily to mean killings, because we understand genocide as mass killings, what happened in Rwanda, what's happening in Gaza, and in some other different places. But you give a population a choice. You die or get out. So you literally get a condition of life that I do not have the options but to flee, or else I will die. So you crash your service. That's actually the purpose. You create a jungle that, and they know, and they never hide. They are so open in this. We have the letters. It's not like something we don't know. We have the letters. We know who signed it, telling them, please put the money into this account. And then they come in public and say, we are actually doing it so that you get out. So it's so deliberate and so systematic and so often and so destructive. So it's not necessarily means must be the killing of half of the populations. It's the torture, the mental torture. If you see, for example, the video of the Maasai, they go to the mountain, it's like, this is the end of the world. They do not know what will happen tomorrow. They do not have, you know, like segregation can take many forms. You can get something slightly different from the other. We're not getting anything at all. And whoever, actually, one of the political leader in the opposition tried to go and hold a political rally in my place. He was arrested. He never even arrived there. He was blocked on the road. He was arrested just because he wanted to go there. And coincidentally, that day I was going home. I'm a lawyer, of course I work in Arusha. Then I was going home. And they told me, where are you going? I told them, I'm going home. Home where? Home in Entulen, in Ngorongoro. Doing what? Hey, this is my home. I'm going home. They told me, the only possible way for you to reach that area is if we take your body. We kill you and take your body to home. And I wrote that in the Left Berlin newspaper, so you can read. I was prevented to go because it coincidentally met with the politician going to Ngorongoro. So they thought maybe I'm going for a political rally, which is not a crime if I decide to go. I remember the apartheid history in South Africa, that you are asked, what is the ID? I know in Tanzania that if the Maasai want to go, he'll be told, what is your ID? And I asked them, which one? They said, your national ID. And said, do you think I'm not a citizen? They said, no, we just want to see it. Okay, you don't have that. Okay, and maybe, and I always ask, and in some occasion, I told them, no, I'm not going to produce the national ID unless you accuse me that I'm not a citizen, then I show. It's a very chaotic place to stay. It's very beautiful in eyes. Is the land that we need more than any, but we are really suffering as people.
Yeah, no, and everything you're describing, to me, it's just like textbook genocide. And even especially what you were saying too, with creating that like mental fear and everything, that's like a huge part of it as well. But is there anything else that you want to share with us that you think is important for people to understand about the Maasai people and what's happening?
Yes. Because it is important to understand, we are not about issues of conservation here. And we are not about anything but two things. Business, then the intention to destruct or destroy certain communities. And I think this is the reason why. Because if someone is employed, why do you go and... Because, for example, there is now a policy in Ngorongoro for private operators, 2 hours operators, not to employ the Maasai. That's the government policy written. They write letters, please do not employ any of the Maasai in this area. In Tanzania, there are 120 tribes. I'm not speaking because I'm a Maasai, I'm just trying to say the facts. It's the only community that I have found somewhere written, the Maasai are not allowed here. In the hotel, not in Ngorongoro. In cities, Arusha, Dar es Salaam. So you go to somewhere and you saw like a billboard written, Maasai are not allowed here. And it's, what the hell is this? And sometimes back, and we thought it was a joke. We never knew, now we feel it. some media saying there was an accident and seven people dies and two Maasai. I don't know if you understand it. Seven people and two Maasai. We thought it was a joke, but then with the situation that we found ourselves in, we feel like it was a long systematic feelings. And that's why some people are saying they do not bury dead bodies. Those are the media people saying and telling the government, take all of them, they do not practice what we do. Is that a fact? Of course not. But how to justify? So you give some awkward image to justify what is being done. And genocide will never happen without propaganda. So there are many mechanisms of propaganda, regularly the media. If you read Tanzanian media, you follow is like hell. It's like we are not ordinary human beings, which actually explain why many factors are actually appearing. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, no, thank you for sharing all of that. I think that really helps explain, just like tie together everything that you shared. And lastly, if like our listeners want to keep up with your work and the stuff that you do in the legal field, do you have any social medias or anywhere where people can follow you?
Yes, because I said we worked actually so much in the media. By 2022, I was in touch close to more than 100 journalists to try to cover the issue, not one actually Tanzanian. So you can understand the problem. Then, because I said speaking so much with the media, but particularly on the ground, then doing with the cases, trying in many ways that we can, but particularly also organizing communities to ensure that, because if the people are speaking out, then you have a silent community, then that advocacy is almost zero. So we also try to coordinate communities to ensure that at least they resist peacefully in their own ways, which actually they are doing so more than actually enough. So yes, in social media, in Facebook, Joseph Mozole Shangai, in Twitter, at Ole Shangai. Ole Shangai, the way, the same spelling is OleShangai, at Ole Shangai. More so particularly Twitter and Facebook, which I mostly tweet about the problems. Of course, and among others, issues related to governance, democracy, human rights. Yeah.
Thank you so much. Yeah, thank you so much for sharing. It was really great having you as a guest. And I feel like I learned a lot. And I think just this conversation is so important because it ties to a lot of things that I think people in the like genocide scholarship field are like grappling with today. But yeah, So thank you again for sharing and speaking with us.
Thank you very much, sir.
Thank you for joining us on this episode of Conversations on Genocide. We hope these discussions have provided some insight and understanding into the complex topic of genocide. If you'd like to stay connected and continue engaging with us, you can find more information on our website at www.genocidewatch.com and on our social media accounts linked in the show notes. Together, we can make a difference by raising awareness, fostering empathy, and taking action against genocide. Stay tuned for more content in the future.